makes sense that around the time of spring break, we would have stories of sun, sand, and squid on today's show. That's coming up in just a couple minutes. I'm Carl Azus, and we begin with a warning sign. A major international bank is predicting that a recession could be on the horizon for the United States. What, when, and why is how we'll break this down. The what is a potential recession itself. It's defined as a period of decreased economic activity, when a nation's gross domestic product contracts or shrinks. The effects of a recession might include fewer retail sales, less manufacturing, lower income, and more people without jobs. The organization predicting this is Deutsche Bank. It's a corporation based in Germany that has a network in 58 countries from Europe to America to Asia. It's the first major financial institution that's predicting a recession in the U.S., though some other economic groups have said chances are growing for one. When would this hit? Deutsche Bank says probably between late next year and early 2024, though it adds there's, quote, considerable uncertainty about the timing and how bad the recession might be. So is this doom and gloom? Not necessarily. The bank thinks the potential recession will be mild, lasting a relatively short time. It may be a matter of months, with an unemployment rate of more than 5% hitting in 2024. For perspective, the current rate, the percentage of American workers who don't have jobs, is 3.6%. Why would any of this happen? Inflation, the rapid rise in prices for the things we buy, has grown by its fastest pace in 40 years. Economic experts think prices will probably stay high for the foreseeable future. There is a tool that America's central bank has to try to reduce inflation. The Federal Reserve can raise interest rates, which makes it more expensive to borrow money, and that can help lead to price decreases. But there are side effects to that. Deutsche Bank says because inflation is so high, it thinks the Fed will raise interest rates so quickly that it'll slam the brakes on economic growth and put the U.S. into recession. Again, none of this is certain, but the bank thinks all of these events will align in the years ahead.
So what's the difference between a recession and a depression? It comes down to how long the economy contracts. A recession is typically defined as two negative quarters of economic growth, and as part of the normal business cycle. The U.S. economy has fallen into recession more than 30 times since 1854. A depression is something vastly different. It happens when the economic decline is sustained and might potentially go on for years. Now, that's only occurred once in American history in 1929, and it lasted 10 years. Because it lasts so long, a depression is more severe. A decade ago, unemployment hit 10% during the worst of the Great Recession, but during the Great Depression, the jobless rate peaked at nearly 25%.
10-second trivia. Which word can describe a thread-like object or a plasma extension on the sun? Firmament, fragment, filament, or figment? Filament is the answer, and it factors into a recent solar storm. Regardless of what the weather outside is like where you're watching, we are all being hit by a solar storm. A coronal mass ejection from a filament lifted off the sun on March 3rd, according to the U.S. government. And the effects of this were predicted to hit the Earth on Wednesday and Thursday. So what does that mean? Hopefully not much. Even though solar storms can cause problems on Earth by disrupting GPS, satellites, and the power grid, the one hitting now is relatively minor. It's classified as a G1 on a scale from G1 to G5, with the G standing for geomagnetic and the 1 being the weakest classification on the NOAA geomagnetic storm scale. So why and how are scientists keeping up with these events?
Solar storms have been known to cause all kinds of trouble, disrupting flights and power grids. Sounds kind of scary. So how worried should we actually be? The weather on the sun is a little different than the weather here on Earth. It consists of solar wind, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, which are these giant bubbles of plasma and magnetic fields from the sun that send high-speed particles into space. These storms can last a few minutes or several hours, and even though they're happening over 90 million miles away, they're so powerful that their effects can linger in our magnetosphere and atmosphere for days or weeks. If directed at Earth, these flares and CMEs create geomagnetic storms that then dazzle us with spectacular auroras. But that's the fun part. Beyond a light show, these solar storms can harm most modern-day technology like satellites, communication systems, power grids, and airplanes. They can make airplanes disappear from radar detection and cause major blackouts. In 1989, a solar storm caused a blackout in Canada that left 6 million without power for 12 hours. While our technology is at the mercy of these solar storms, our bodies are not. That's because the Earth's atmosphere shields us from harmful radiation. But astronauts who are traveling through space won't be as lucky. Shielding astronauts from the space weather is something NASA is working on right now to make sure our astronauts are safe and shielded on future deep space missions. But back here on Earth, there's a facility in Boulder, Colorado that monitors the sun's forecast. It's called the Space Weather Prediction Center. So by getting ahead of the space weather, we can better protect our technology.
The second of two reports from CNN's Rachel Crane today takes us out to sea. Tidal energy is a relatively new form of power production. The publication NS Energy says it's possible it could damage marine life or change shorelines, and it has to be built close to land because it relies on powerful currents to generate energy. Also, not everyone supports using taxpayer dollars to subsidize or support green energy, but the technology is moving forward.
For decades, wind and solar have been the centerpieces of green energy. But the ocean's ever-constant waves and tides are also rich with renewable power that has remained largely untapped. Off the coast of Scotland, Orbital Marine Power is one of the companies trying to change that. Its jumbo jet-sized floating platform, called the O2, has two giant rotors that sit 60 feet below the surface of the water and can harness the energy of the ocean's tides.
It's kinetic energy, so the bits of technology that generate the power look not too different to a wind turbine.
But unlike wind turbines that have to accommodate for wind coming from all directions, the O2 only needs to capture energy from two.
You have a flood tide when the tide comes in, and you have an ebb tide when the tide goes out.
And tides are far more reliable than wind.
You can predict those motions years and decades into advance.
This is Orbital's third tidal turbine system to be connected to the UK national grid for testing since 2012. This latest design features rotors that can lift out of the water for easier access for repairs. The company says one O2 unit generates up to 2 megawatts, which it says is enough to power around 2,000 homes a year.
Think of what Vernon Power's doing at Roosevelt Island in New York City. It's what the Wright brothers did at Kitty Hawk.
In the U.S., Verdant Power's tri-frame system operates at the bottom of the East River, which is actually a tidal strait. It's in a pre-commercial phase, but actively delivers power to New York City's electric grid.
The potential for marine energy is something like 250 gigawatts around the world, and that's just tidal. It doesn't include rivers or large canals. So you can see the potential for the applications, not only our technology, but our competitors as well. I mean, there's lots of room, and we really hope our competitors succeed too for the sake of the industry, but we've got to get our costs down.
Right now, the high cost of building, operating, and maintaining tidal power technology means that tidal energy comes at a premium, but government investment could play a vital role in driving the price tag down.
In the UK, there are economic incentives. We're counting on those for our first commercial projects. As we start mass producing the technology, we're going to pivot from the UK and head right back to North America. Alaska, New York, Canada, tremendous water currents everywhere to harvest.
Squid have been known to change color in the wild, likely to avoid being seen and eaten. But could they be observed doing this in captivity? The answer, as you can see, is yes. Scientists at a lab in Japan noticed that while they were cleaning out the squid tank, the cephalopods appeared to be different colors depending on whether they were near the algae. One experiment later, a climactic chameleon color conversion was quickly confirmed. Some of you might be hoping I'll just squid while I'm ahead. You know, squidaddle before I start squidding around. Just because I love puns doesn't mean I'm calamaried to them. But whether you're streaming the show or watching the Cephala podcast, you know I like to drop a few or a plank ton of them because they're totally tubular and tasteful to a wide array of palates. Staples High School in Westport, Connecticut. Shout out to you for subscribing and leaving a comment on our YouTube channel. I'm Carl Azus for CNN.